I'm Brandon Hollingsworth, and from WUOT News, this is Dialogue. From vast oceans to volcanic plugs to continental collisions and even the one time that North America tried to pull itself apart at the seams, Tennessee's story is written in its rocks. You flip through the pages and you're flipping through millions of years of geologic time and history. A lot of the way we live today, from our highways to our homes and schools and businesses, can be explained by the rocks under our feet. Today on Dialogue, we'll be joined by two geologists, Bob Hatcher and Harry Moore, who will be able to interpret that geologic story from page to page, and we'll tell it from start to finish. Join us for the discussion. Join us for Dialogue. It's the story of Tennessee as told through the rocks. That's coming up after this hour's news. Minutes past 1 o'clock on this Wednesday, today the fourth day of September 2013. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth and welcome to WUOT's Dialogue. If you think that this hour is going to be an hour-long lecture about rocks, a very dry subject indeed, throw out that notion immediately, because in this hour we instead intend to tell the dynamic story of Tennessee and her people as viewed through the lens of geologic times and conditions. What can the rocks tell us that informs us about the way we live? Joining me today are two very gifted interpreters of that geologic story, and they'll be helping me tell that story. Dr. Bob Hatcher at the University of Tennessee. He's a distinguished scientist in both geology and tectonics. He's a former president of the Geological Society of America and the only geologist in the Southeast to receive the Society's Penrose Medal. That was in recognition of his scientific contributions. And Harry Moore worked for years as a geologist with the Tennessee Department of Transportation. He's the author of three general audience books about Tennessee's geology, and he was instrumental in the discovery of the now famous Gray fossil site up in Washington County, which we'll talk about later this hour. Gentlemen, welcome to Dialogue, to both of you.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Very good to have you as well. I want to start kind of at the beginning with this discussion. We talked about how the story of the rocks informs us about the way Tennessee came to be. And for that, we have to go even further east than Knoxville. As a general rule, the rocks get older the further east you go, from the Mississippi River to the North Carolina line. We have to go right up to the North Carolina line to find, indeed, the oldest rocks in the state. And Dr. Moore, I guess we'll start with you. What are the oldest rocks in the state of Tennessee, and what do they tell us? When geologists look at those rocks, those igneous and metamorphic rocks, what do we learn?
Well, to find these old rocks, typically you would go to Unicoi County and Carter County and try to find exposures of the granite gneiss that is believed to have been part of the remains of the old Grenville orogeny. Dr. Hatcher can speak more to that than I can, but those would be the areas to find the oldest rocks in Tennessee.
And I would jump in here to say that granite gneiss is not just a description of gneiss granite. It's gneiss is a metamorphic rock, in other words, a rock that has been changed in some way by heat and pressure.
Correct.
Typically through continental collisions.
Correct.
What's interesting to me about this is that the Earth, we all learn in earth science in middle school, is a little more than 4.5 billion years old. But the oldest rocks in Tennessee are about 1 billion years old or thereabouts, meaning that, to put it in another way, only the most recent 25% of the Earth's history would be contained within the rocks here in Tennessee. And even then, there are gaps, like the Permian period from the Paleozoic is missing in Tennessee. And so the complete story isn't there by any stretch. So, Dr. Hatcher, when we look at these very old granites and metamorphic rocks, what do we learn?
Well, we learn something about the environments in which they formed. We learn a great deal about the process of continental collision, and actually studies of isotopic concentrations of lead in these old rocks suggest that they really are not North American, that they really belong in South America. Huh. And these are billion-year-old rocks that are the result of the formation of a supercontinent we call Rodinia. And then this supercontinent contains rocks both from North America and South America. And they got left behind when Rodinia broke up.
And when Rodinia broke up, apparently an ocean kind of came in to fill that gap as the continents pulled apart. So we're left with pieces of South America stuck to the edge of Tennessee. Mm-hmm. And for something like that, that's kind of hard for, I think, a lot of people to understand, because it's such a wild concept to look at a world map the way it's currently configured and think about continents running into each other. But this is a process that has happened several times in Tennessee's history.
That's correct. The Rodinia was the second best-known supercontinent. Another, though, formed at the end of what we call the Paleozoic about 250 million years ago. And that supercontinent we call Pangaea. And then it broke up when the Atlantic Ocean opened. So we've had two complete cycles of supercontinent formations recorded in Tennessee.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are also, are there smaller, and when you say an orogeny, that's a period of mountain building. That is when mountains are formed. And there are places on Earth where that's happening right now, like in the Himalayas, where India is kind of running into Asia, and that's building up the Himalayas and the Andes of South America to some extent. That same process was happening here in Tennessee a couple of different times in our state's history. And I think one of the common legends about East Tennessee's geology is that the Appalachians at one point, people like to say, were kind of like the Rockies. Is that true?
That's probably true, yes. Yeah.
So how did we get from Purple Mountain's majesty to the cool green hills of Tennessee? What happened?
Well, at the end of the Paleozoic, 250 million years ago, we had the collision between Africa, North America, South America to form the supercontinent. That produced a double section of crust, just like we see in India going under Asia today. And so as a result of that, you got this extremely high mountain chain in this region, the same as we're seeing in the Himalayas today. Now, then afterwards, and as the supercontinent of Pangaea broke up, these mountains were essentially eroded away and produced a rolling topography like we have in the Piedmont. And the topography we have today is a very young topography. It's almost like saying that the mountains here are not the oldest mountains in the world, and they are not. They're very young. There are many things that tell us that. Maybe we can get to that later.
Okay. Harry Moore, I want to bring you back into the conversation for just a minute to talk about geology and life, because as we talk about the Appalachians, obviously we have to talk about our interactions with those mountains. We live in this area, people in western North Carolina and Virginia, all the way up into Pennsylvania, and there are certain characteristics that we kind of come to understand. And one thing, I moved here from Alabama, and actually from a particularly flat part of Alabama around Tuscaloosa. So when I got here, it seemed like constantly I was hearing about highways being closed because of rock slides and landslides and things like that. So when we wake up as a commuter, for instance, I wake up and I see Alcoa Highway is closed because of a rock slide. That's an inconvenience. When you wake up and hear that Alcoa Highway is closed because of a rock slide, what does that mean to you as a geologist? What do we learn from that?
Well, we understand that the bedrock has been fractured many times from the folding and the faulting. And through the weathering process, these joints, these fractures widen and produce rock falls and rock slides. And it's a time to go back out and look to see what we may have missed the first time if we design the cut, and to try to come up with a good way to fix it. Now, there are a number of different types of landslides that we experience here. Most of the time, it's rock falls that people interact with, but we have rotational failures, block glide landslides, wedge failures. Those are the main types.
And I know, of course, it happens frequently on Interstate 40 between Tennessee and North Carolina as well. Mm. Last summer, of course, we had the highly publicized, kind of a different thing. Instead of the mountain falling onto the highway, the mountain fell out from under Interstate 75 up in Campbell County. And what that demonstrates is that the Earth is constantly changing anyway. Like, these processes would be happening anyway. The only reason we as humans notice is because there's a highway involved.
Right. We, as humans, try to manipulate the environment to suit our needs, but when we do that, there is a price to be paid when we get into unstable or potentially unstable geologic conditions, and landslides are as a result of of that interaction.
Well, and Interstate 40 gets a double dose of this, and Dr. Hatcher, I want you to jump in at some point because I know you have some opinions on this, because not only does it have to go kind of wind its way through to North Carolina through some very steep terrain that is susceptible to rock slides and falls, it also has to climb the Cumberland Plateau to go over to Nashville. So you get two areas on either side of East Tennessee where this highway is sort of at risk. And is that... Is there ever going to be such a thing as a landslide-proof highway in this region, or is this just something we have to get used to? Making these repairs, having the highway closed, is just a way of life.
Short answer to that is no. We will always have to deal with instabilities in the landscape. The more we learn, the better we can design future projects to minimize those types of geohazards. But rock falls and landslides will continue to be with us as we try to carve our way through the landscape in East Tennessee.
That's a good news for commuters, all of us, These will continue to happen. Dr. Hatcher, when Interstate 40 was built, of course, they had many of these problems in the late 60s and early 70s, and we're still dealing with them today. As a geologist, when you look at 40, what would you try to improve about it if you had to design it all over again today?
If I had to design it all over again, I might choose a different route.
Mm-hmm.
There are natural landslides in the Pigeon River Gorge that you can go out and you can see them on the inside of the river today. And so this has been a history that's been recurring over and over again throughout modern times and prehistoric times as well. So these events are going to continue to happen despite the fact that we have very good engineering geologists like Harry and others that work for the North Carolina State Highway Department. They're very good people. And what they would like to do is to be able to predict these slides. And yet, it's extremely difficult to do so because you don't really know what's going to trigger one.
Or when, precisely. Sometimes you just don't know when. Yes. You wake up one morning and the highway's been blocked.
Yes.
And, that brings us to an important point that I wanted to hit kind of again and again in this hour is when I talk to people about my passion for geology, people are like, rocks, they're rocks. Nobody cares. Yeah, rocks, you know. But the idea is geology can influence very much the way we live. And we'll get into another portion of the show. We'll talk a little bit about the New Madrid seismic zone. We'll talk about sinkhole risks as well, things that are very real ways of describing geology to people in a way that makes it sort of snap into place, that it's not purely academic. And Dr. Hatcher, I know, of course, you have a foot in both worlds. You have to be an ambassador for geology as well, someone who studies it professionally. How do you communicate to people the idea that rocks are not arcane, that they really do matter?
Well, try to explain as best we can the history they contain, but also when we look at the processes that are going on today to tell us, to tell people these are things that we can explain. We can't always predict them, but we can certainly explain the occurrence of landslides. We can explain earthquakes. We know what they are, but again, we can predict neither of them to the level that we need to. And the landslides that we see in this part of the country, these are relatively small slides compared to some of those that are in the prehistoric record. You can actually go around the Gatlinburg Loop Road, just south of Gatlinburg, and see pieces of rock that are derived from way up on Mount LeConte that are the size of dump trucks and things like that. Those rocks moved 2-3 miles horizontally. And these are parts of large landslides that we can see there and in other places in this region. And so these are the small landslides we get here are landslides that we see that are happening, and they're damaging. There's no question they're costly to clean up. But I hope we don't have one of these really large ones anytime soon.
We're coming up on 19 minutes past the hour of 1 o'clock. We're going to pause right now for a station break. More with Dr. Bob Hatcher and Harry Moore as we continue to tell Tennessee's geologic story on Dialogue from WUOT News. 20 minutes after 1 o'clock, you're listening to Dialogue from WUOT News. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. And today we're telling the story of Tennessee as told through the rocks. It's a fascinating story, one that spans more than a billion years from the Precambrian and before the big explosion of life all the way to September 4th, 2013, because geology is a process that's still happening, and we'll get to some of the ways that it's still happening and still affecting our lives in just a moment. Before the break, we were talking to Dr. Bob Hatcher of the University of Tennessee about landslides and the way they affect life here in Tennessee. And Harry Moore, of course, you worked with that directly because you were an engineering geologist for the Department of Transportation.
Correct. Dealing with landslides involves a number of different processes. One of those, the landslides that occur on 40 around Rockwood and also up on I-75 in Campbell County, are generally the result of building the highway on top of colluvium. And colluvium is basically a talus deposit that forms along the escarpment of large
stuff that has fallen down a mountain
and accumulated over a period of time.
Yeah.
And in some places, this material is can be over 100 feet thick and has developed a soil mantle over it so that to the untrained eye, you wouldn't know that you were standing on unstable ground.
Looks like solid ground.
Right. And you build a highway embankment on top of it. Well, it cannot hold. It doesn't have the shear strength to hold the weight of that embankment, and so it slides out from underneath the highway, which causes the highway to slide down.
There goes part of Interstate 75, right down the side of that mountain.
That's right.
Same thing. Is that the same process that happened when the Newfound Gap Road collapsed on the other side of the North Carolina line? After we had a lot of heavy rain, I think it was back in June or July, we saw that highway slide something like 50 feet down a hillside.
Right. I don't know how much colluvium was involved, probably mm-hmm. some. But there was a lot of springs in the area that mm-hmm. saturated not only the embankment, but the ground beneath the embankment. And I would say that that's probably had a big role in it sliding away.
By the way, I want to let our listeners know, if you're just joining us, that the subject here, Tennessee's geologic story, the story of our state as told through the pages of the rock layers under our feet. We'd like to hear from you. You can send us a question on Twitter at WUOTFM. You can drop us a line at our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/WUOTFM. Or give us a call the old-fashioned way at 974-5050. We have a questioner already on the line. Terry, you are on Dialogue. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. Dr. Hatcher, I think it was mentioned that fracturing of rock can cause landslides, but doesn't it also lead to erosion and sinkholes such as happened on I-40? And how's that going to affect the people that live above it when it rocks fractured, especially by hydraulic fracturing?
Well, I should point out those are two different processes. We're talking about there's natural fracturing that's caused by erosion and things like that, and then hydraulic fracturing, which is a human-made process. Dr. Hatcher, could you tell us maybe a bit more about those?
Well, it depends on where the location of where the people are living or where they're located at the time the landslide occurs. It goes out from beneath them. It may oversteepen the slope and increase the potential of a landslide that could bring a structure down, such as a house or some other kind of thing, a garage or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It just depends on where the location of the structure of concern is and as to whether or not there's a real danger.
Okay. And Terry, thank you so much for that question. We appreciate it. I want to move on to a subject that's interesting to me and I think to a lot of Tennesseans, the New Madrid Seismic Zone. When we talk about that, that is over on the west side of the state, but it's something that gets a lot of media attention in the mid-Mississippi River Valley. Let's just kind of talk about what that is. When we think of seismic zones, I think a lot of us landlubber Easterners are thinking about like the San Andreas Fault, something big and dramatic that breaks the surface and creates mountains and things like that. But the New Madrid Seismic Zone actually is all underground. It's kind of buried under the floodplain of the Mississippi River. So let's talk a little bit, and I guess, Dr. Moore, would you tell us a little bit about the reason I turned to you is that this is a process that's called rifting. The reason that this thing even exists at all is the North American continent kind of tried to come apart of itself, kind of unzipped itself. Tell us what happens when there's rifting.
Well, rifting simply means that the crust is trying to pull apart, and there's different reasons for that. From our understanding, that zone never succeeded in fully developing, but it's a weak Mm-hmm. It is a weak zone in the crust. And because of that, the Gulf of Mexico has moved up onto that area of the southeastern U.S. and deposited sediments over time. And the weight of those sediments continue to press down against this
kind of the weak spot,
weak area, and movements still occur there today. Dr. Hatcher can probably address that better from a structural standpoint than
I. Let's go to that. Dr. Hatcher, when you think about the New Madrid seismic zone, how do you explain it to people?
Well, when we think of large earthquakes occurring, say, in the United States, we commonly think about the San Andreas Fault or some of the others that are on plate boundaries, such as the Cascadia subduction zone off Washington, Oregon. Or if you think about Turkey or Iran, again, you're on plate boundaries. Unfortunately, the earthquakes that we have in the central U.S. and the interiors of other continents, including here in East Tennessee, are difficult to explain. And so these are called intraplate earthquakes because they're not on plate boundaries. The New Madrid earthquakes that occurred in 1811 and 1812 were four very large earthquakes that occurred in December, January, and February of 1811 and 1812. It was hypothesized a few years ago that this is related to reactivation of old rift faults that we can identify in the subsurface using aeromagnetic data. Interestingly, today, the taking into account the locations of most of the earthquakes and the sense of motion that's derived from the earthquakes, the thing they're coming up with now is that this is really a strike-slip fault system and not pulling apart of the crust there. It is a strike-slip fault system that has components of compression elsewhere in it that are producing what we call thrust faults, where rocks are moved up and over other rocks. And the models seem to fit that much better because the earthquakes are really not located on the old rift faults. They're out in the middle of what would be the rift zone itself.
I'll be darned. And just for the benefit of our listeners, I want to point out that a strike-slip fault is one like the San Andreas, in which the two pieces of rock are moving past one another and not over or under. It's a horizontal motion. Right. And that is quite different than what you're talking about in a rift valley, where typically that's going to be a vertical motion in toward the center of that rift.
That's correct.
That is fascinating. So there's another seismic zone here, the East Tennessee seismic zone, or the Southern Appalachian seismic zone, depends on what you call it. And you're saying that this is a bit of a mystery. We can't quite figure out why this is a zone of seismic activity?
We do know that the East Tennessee seismic zone is a completely separate seismic zone from New Madrid. That's pretty clear. And like the New Madrid seismic zone, we do not know what the cause of the earthquakes is here. We've never had a large earthquake here. The largest has been about a 4.6 or 4.8 magnitude. But we've had several of those up and down the seismic zone as far south as Fort Payne, Alabama, and as far north as north of Knoxville, and perhaps even into Kentucky, if that's part of the same zone. East Tennessee happens to be the second most active seismic zone in the eastern United States from activity. New Madrid has had large earthquakes. Charleston's had one large earthquake, and it's very inactive. And then there are other places in the eastern United States where we've also had fairly large earthquakes, but we have this high frequency of small earthquakes and medium-sized earthquakes, but never a large one. So I like to tell the seismologists that work in New Madrid that they've already had their earthquakes. We haven't had ours yet.
That's reassuring, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I want to ask a little bit more about this because, again, if we look at a fault zone, and we'll use San Andreas because it's so well-known to the American public, it's been heavily studied. You know, you're able to go out there. It's at the surface. You can put lasers on either side of it. You can put seismometers and get scientists and stake out the thing and just watch it go. But here, these fault zones are taking place very deep underground. You can't just go and look at them. You know, they're miles, in some cases, miles beneath the surface. So how then do you investigate the seismic zones in East Tennessee or in New Madrid out in West Tennessee if you can't get to them? How do we study them? How do we know about them?
We look at the collateral damage they've caused in the past, and we try to date in some way when these events occurred and how frequently they occur. In New Madrid, they've been studying that area for 20, 30 years or longer, and pretty intensively. And so they have a lot of information on how frequently earthquakes of large magnitude recur there, something on the order of 500 to 600 years. Here in East Tennessee, we have no idea yet as to the recurrence interval of large, of even any kind of earthquakes. But we do now have evidence that there have been earthquakes of magnitude greater than 6.5 here, probably 6.5 to 7. So we do have evidence of having had fairly large earthquakes here in the past. We have no idea yet as to the recurrence interval, though.
Do we know how long ago those earthquakes occurred here?
They are post 15,000 years. That is more recently than 15,000 years ago,
yeah,
from age dates that we've obtained actually on sediments out on Douglas Lake.
Okay.
And we can actually see small structures out there, faults that have displacements of maybe 2 to 3 feet. And so this is, we think, collateral damage that was produced by some of these larger earthquakes that have been here in the prehistoric past. And we've dated the sediments, and the sediments themselves in which they're part are about 15,000 years old.
Which in geologic time is not very long at all, and that was very, very recent. Well, speaking of something that happened in the recent past, geologically speaking, Mr. Moore, you were working in the spring of 2000 when TDOT was working on a road widening project near a town called Gray Station in Washington County. And the engineers working on that TDOT project discovered that there was an unusual layer of clay that they didn't really know what to do with. They knew it was not going to be a suitable base for their road they were trying to build, but they didn't really know what to make of it, so they called you. So you go up to Gray Station in the spring of 2000. What did you find there?
Well, what we saw was very black to gray, sandy clay to almost just black clay, which is highly unusual for this area. Occasionally you'll find an old deposit, an ice age pond that is left over that has not been eroded away, but this was fairly thick, and the soft sediment was causing a construction problem. We had to come up with a solution. But during our investigation and we invited other geologists from the Division of Geology and the university to come and look at this, because I felt that this was a very unusual exposure of material that had never been seen before in Tennessee. And sure enough, as it has turned out, we started finding bones of mammals and reptiles that's buried in the sediment, and they were beautifully preserved. And fortunately, we were able to get the road moved so that we could give the site over to science for study and for also for education purposes. And it was a remarkable experience. Something that a geologist never gets to experience once every two or three lifetimes. I was very fortunate to be a part of that. There were a number of people that were involved in that.
And that, of course, is called the Gray Fossil Site today, and as you said, is kept open as something for educational purposes, scientific. People can visit and go see it instead of it being buried under a road widening project. But I wanted to ask you just a bit more in detail about that, about the environment. Because when we find fossils just aren't laying around everywhere. There's going to be a reason that fossils are preserved. And in this case, it was a pond millions of years ago, but it was a pond.
Right. What's so special about the Gray Fossil Site is that everything, the animals were buried in context, meaning that they were buried in the environment that they lived in, and that environment was preserved. And what we think today is that this was a pond created by a sinkhole collapse, very large, maybe several that coalesced into one large one, and that the pond was spring-fed, supported an environment that may have lasted 500 years, 1,000, maybe several thousand years, long enough for fish to develop there, for amphibians, reptiles, and then, of course, the mammals that inhabited the place.
There was a big surprise that came along with that as well. Not just the surprise of the discovery itself, but the surprise of how far back it went. Initially, you were saying this might have been an ice age deposit, 10, 15,000 years old, not that long ago. But when you started getting in some results about what kinds of fossils you were finding and what species they belonged to, it was far older than that.
Right. We, for the first couple of months, we thought we were dealing with ice age material, Pleistocene, which pretty much ended about 10,000 years ago. So we were thinking this may be 10 to 15, 18,000 years old. But we started finding fossils that didn't match the ice age. And one of those was an alligator skull that Rick Noseworthy found. He's a TDOT employee. And that threw up a big red flag. And then I happened to find a jaw and tooth of an animal that we weren't sure what it was. And Dr. Parmalee, he's deceased now, but he was with the UT Anthropology Department, had a friend out in Nebraska named Dr. Voorhees. And he said, can I send this to him? And I said, sure, go ahead. Well, as soon as he gets it, he calls Dr. Parmalee and says, where did you find this? And Dr. Parmalee said, here in East Tennessee. And he said, no, come on, you're kidding me. Where did you find it? He said, East Tennessee. And he said, well, what is it? And he said, this is rhinoceros. This is the same species of rhinoceros I'm working on out in Nebraska. So that immediately changed the age of the material from 10, 15,000 years to at least 4.5 to 5 million.
How about that?
Yeah, and I mean, it completely changed the whole approach to what was going on there.
Yeah, and that's an amazing thing to talk about, too, in context with the way we think of Tennessee today. We're familiar with the animals and the plants that live here today. At the time, 4 or 5 million years ago, of course, Tennessee was a very different place. What did we learn from the Gray Fossil Site? What if we were here or at that site 4.5 million years ago, what kind of landscape would we be looking at?
I would say the landscape would probably not be a whole lot different than what we see today. Now, the animals obviously would be lots of elephant-type animals, alligators, rhinoceros, probably a few camels walking around. Then you have your turtles and other wildlife. Dr. Hatcher has an idea about the development of the Blue Ridge landscape beginning possibly 7 million years ago. So this fossil site fits right into that, because we think it's maybe 5 to 7 million years in age. Mm-hmm. So something was going on at that time, and it was lots of life around, terrestrial life. And so Dr. Hatcher may have a comment about what the landscape may have looked like.
Well, I don't think we can overemphasize the importance of the Gray Site and the discovery you guys made up there, and the fact that it does give us a realm of 5 to 7 million years of time in which these animals lived. Today, just in itself, the Gray Site sits, 200 feet above the nearest creek bed?
Right.
That's on a ridgetop or hilltop. So that means that area has either been eroded 200 feet down next to it, or it's been uplifted. And so this is where we begin to talk about the whether or not the mountains that we're looking at here in East Tennessee and western North Carolina are really as old as many people say they are. That these mountains may actually have been uplifted and formed since 7 million years ago.
So the phrase, old as the hills, may not be as old as we think.
Exactly. Yeah. And there are a lot of other evidence. I'm not going to go through it all right here, but the fact that just the topography that we have here is high in the southern Appalachians. We have something like 59 named 6,000-foot mountains here. And yet, when you go from North Carolina into Virginia, the high topography leaves the Blue Ridge and goes into the Valley of Virginia and then continues into West Virginia. And so this is rather an enigma with respect to the topography itself. If you want to think this is the oldest topography in North America or something like that, then you've got to explain things like that. And so this, the little bits and pieces of information are making us suspicious about the actual age of the topography we're looking at today.
We want to hear your questions, 974-5050. You can submit your questions online on Twitter, at WUOTFM, or go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/WUOTFM. At 39 and a half minutes before the hour, we'll pause for a station break. This is Dialogue from WUOT News. Back now with Dialogue, continuing to tell Tennessee's geologic story. The good, the bad, the ugly, earthquakes, volcanoes, oceans, the whole schmack, as they say. And in fact, that brings us to an important point about things that have smacked into the earth at one point or another. There are a couple of impact structures in and around Tennessee. In fact, I find it quite interesting that the town of Middlesboro, Kentucky, which is within our listening area, in fact, one of my colleagues is from Middlesboro, sits smack in the middle of an impact crater created by an asteroid or comet that hit the earth. We have two or three more down here in Tennessee proper. First of all, of course, it demonstrates that we live in kind of an active shooting gallery, cosmically speaking, but it also tells us a little something about geology. It's one of those cool oddities that we find from time to time. And so, Dr. Hatcher, we'll go to you and ask about these impact structures as they come up in Tennessee. How do we know that that's what they are in the first place? Because for a while, for decades in the 20th century, nobody was quite certain with any kind of surety that these were in fact asteroid craters.
Right. Well, these things were originally called cryptovolcanic structures, which means hidden volcanic structures, and people talked about them forming as gas exploded down deep in the earth and produced these things, because they do have sort of a shape that might indicate that rocks around the center are uplifted and this sort of thing. But then we started gathering evidence, again, little bits and pieces of evidence. For example, there are cone-shaped structures in these, most of them. We call them shatter cones today. And the points of these cones point upward to a common point, usually, and that's usually the place where the impact occurred. And so the idea then came about that these are the result of what are called hypervelocity, extremely high velocity objects coming into the Earth's atmosphere, and if they don't burn up, they hit the Earth's surface and cause a lot of damage. And they've actually been able to estimate the size of these objects that come in by the size of the crater and the nature of the shatter cones, distribution of those, and how much material is brought up in the interior of the impact crater as well.
Yeah. It's something we think about happening, I guess, elsewhere. We're all familiar with the classic pictures of the meteor crater in Arizona, where it's well-preserved, it's relatively young, looks like a crater. Here in Tennessee, they don't have that classic bowl structure. They're very old. They've been eroded. So if you go into a meteor crater here in Tennessee, how would you know where you're in one? Are there any kind of signs that you would look for that indicate that you're sitting inside of a crater?
Well, fortunately, most of the three that we have in Tennessee and also Middlesboro on the state border, when you go into one of those, the rocks surrounding any of these are flat-lying. And so when you suddenly see the rocks standing on end, you should become suspicious that something's going on that shouldn't have happened there, perhaps. The best exposed one of these is probably Wells Creek Basin, over west of Clarksville. It was actually flooded by the Land Between the Lakes reservoir in Kentucky. And so this one had rocks standing on end. It has a very much crushed up interior and abundant shatter cones there. Yeah. And so you have this indication that something has happened there that really might not ought to have happened. And the rocks are totally flat lying all the way around it.
Except for that one
Except
that
for
one
that,
area.
That place.
How about
there, yeah.
That? Mike is on the line with us. Mike, you got a question for our guests?
Yes, I do. Thank you for coming to the show, both of you. I'm really enamored of geology, and I didn't become a geologist. Maybe I should have. But I had a question about, in particular, about the New Madrid Fault. Got me thinking seriously, because I experienced a little earthquake while I was in my little backyard shed, the last one we had. And what was the magnitude of that earthquake? And then the second part of my question is, if New Madrid actually goes in our lifetime, what can we expect here in East Tennessee, and what do you think the effects will be in
the region in Memphis?
Okay, Mike, good question. And Dr. Hatcher, that sounds like it's in your wheelhouse.
When did the earthquake that you felt occur?
I think wasn't it in the spring of this year, it seems like.
I don't remember one. There are small earthquakes around here all the time. And some of them, actually, we think are caused by collapsing caves. Very small magnitude quakes of two or less many times are caused by collapsing caves. But a real earthquake, the last one that we had was last year up in southeastern Kentucky. And we felt it here in East Tennessee. I felt it. It was on a Saturday morning. It may or may not be in the East Tennessee seismic zone. It was a magnitude 4.6 or 3.6, somewhere in that range. But it was clearly one that was felt over a wide area. In terms of New Madrid, your other question about what would happen here in East Tennessee if we had another large earthquake in the New Madrid region, say we had a magnitude 7, there would be collateral damage extending all the way into East Tennessee. The Nashville area would feel it. We would feel it here in East Tennessee. And I'm not sure how much damage there would be to well-built structures, probably very little. If we had a magnitude 6.5 or 7 here in East Tennessee, well-built structures like dams and major engineering structures would probably survive without too much problem. But other things like stores that are supported by vertical posts that have flat roofs that cover a large area, many of those might collapse. Mm-hmm. And that really could cause a lot of damage and perhaps loss of life. And, of course, a lot of old houses, old buildings and things like that would come down. And that would be in East Tennessee where the felt magnitude over here might be down to 6 or so. 5.5 or 6. And if you had a 7 around New Madrid, Memphis area would have a lot of damage. But they've been rebuilding things and have very strict codes now on building of almost any kind. So they're really doing a very good job with trying to anticipate something like that.
What about the average frame residence?
Depends on the foundation. If you sit on solid bedrock, it might not do a lot of damage. If you're sitting on a floodplain where it's water saturated, you may have real problems.
All right. Well, Mike, thank you so much for your question. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Clearly, people care about this sort of thing. I mean, that's the interesting thing about the New Madrid and the East Tennessee seismic zones. I remember, of course, I wasn't in the state when it happened. Of course, I was ironically in California, and we had the earthquake, of course, in Virginia in the summer of 2010 that rocked Washington, Philadelphia, New York, places like that, that I think was a real wake-up call for people that these sort of things happen. Harry, when you talk to, since you have written a couple of books about Tennessee's geology, you're used to communicating the big complicated ideas of geology to an average audience. What are a lot of the questions you get? What does it seem like people are talking about the most when they want to ask you something?
One of the topics is sinkholes and caves. Mm-hmm. People are very frightened about sinkholes, and they occur in a lot of areas of East Tennessee, as well as Middle Tennessee. We have approximately 60% of East Tennessee, or the Valley and Ridge, is underlain by carbonate rock, limestone, dolostone. So the potential is there for caves and sinkholes. And obviously, that's a big geohazard in this area. That's one of the issues. Earthquakes is an issue. Landslides. Those are the three big issues, and then you get into fossils and things like that.
I wanted to spend a little bit of time on sinkholes anyway, so I'm glad you brought that up because it's a question. I was talking to a colleague of mine before I went on the air today, and I said, well, what do you think we should talk about today? And she's like, well, is my house going to fall into a sinkhole? Now, we may not necessarily be able to answer that specific question, but what you're talking about is there is definitely a concern among many East Tennessee residents about sinkholes, because they happen with some degree of frequency out here. It's important to point out that they don't happen just everywhere. You have to have a certain kind of rock under where you're sitting. As you pointed out, limestone, dolostone, marble, in some cases, anything that's made of calcium or calcium carbonate. Why is it those particular kinds of rocks and not others that are susceptible to sinkholes?
Well, those rock strata are soluble in our ground acidic groundwater, as it gets into the fractures within those types of rocks, it slowly dissolves away the rock within the fracture, and over a period of time, thousands and thousands of years, it forms large voids. The sinkhole threat that we experience is not the bedrock collapsing. It's actually the soil above the bedrock that is being eroded down into the cavities and forming voids within the soil, and then the soil actually collapses down into the void. Most all of the sinkholes that we experience are formed that way.
Since a lot of this activity is happening underground, completely out of human sight, is there any way to know before a sinkhole develops that a sinkhole is going to develop?
Well, there's some general things that you can do. If you can walk around in your area and you see naturally occurring sinkholes, closed depressions, well, that's a big red flag that you're in a sinkhole-prone area. Look at a geologic map. If you're in a limestone area, and that is a, that's something you need to be aware of. Let me make this point because it's real important. Society has used most all of the good ground, the geohazard-free ground. We are expanding onto bad, what we call bad ground now, mm-hmm. because all the good ground's used up. One of the bad ground areas are karst areas where sinkholes and caves occur. So we're encroaching on that environment, and people are going to experience more and more subsidence issues because of that.
I want to talk to you about why we see this happening in Tennessee in general. And the idea is when you have areas of limestone, of dolostone, or of marble, you're talking about areas that used to be at the bottom of great big oceans. And so for a period of Tennessee's history called the Ordovician, which was about 400 million years ago, thereabouts, long time ago for us, but not that long ago geologically, there was a vast ocean that covered most of the state and laid down these sediments originally. That's why Tennessee sees so much limestone, right?
Right. And these are carbonate shelves that accumulated sediment for long periods of time. And some of these carbonate sequences are several thousand feet thick. So as Dr. Hatcher mentioned earlier about the formation of Pangaea, all these carbonate shelf areas were broken apart, folded, and uplifted, and formed fractures within mm-hmm. the sediment that eventually, in modern times, let's say, have eroded out into to form all these solution cavities.
And that's also why we have so many caves around here, the popular tourist attractions like the Lost Sea or right. in down in Alabama, Sequoia Caverns and Ruby Falls in Chattanooga.
Right.
All of that would not have been possible had it not been for this mountain of limestone that was deposited over Tennessee over the course of millions of years. We're kind of running toward the end of our hour here, and I always like, whenever I have guests on that are working in currently active fields, I like to ask them, what are the outstanding questions in your field that you would like to see answered in your lifetime? And Mr. Moore, we'll start with you. Questions about Tennessee's geology you think that are still unanswered? Maybe it's about the tectonic history of how the Appalachians came to be, or those very old rocks we talked about at the top of the hour. What questions are still in your mind?
Well, we alluded to this earlier. I think the biggest question from a geologic standpoint in my mind is what did the area look like 7 million years ago or 10 million years ago? And what has happened to produce the landscape that we see and have to deal with in our everyday life? That would be a big question that I would like to see answered.
That'd be cool. Dr. Hatcher, I know you're involved. You and your students all the time are probing the mysteries of the Appalachian Mountains. What are the big questions you'd like to see answered?
Well, I have to agree with Harry that what he has cited is, in my opinion, perhaps the largest unanswered question about the evolution of this region. I've worked my entire life on bedrock and structures in bedrock in the Appalachians, but I've grown interested in, again, the key that comes from graysite and other bits and pieces of information that tell us that this topography we're dealing with here is really a young topography. It may only be 7 million years old. It may be younger. It's been uplifted very rapidly then. We don't understand the process by which this has occurred, just like we don't understand intraplate earthquakes.
Yeah, can I ask, this may be a little wonky, but I'm curious about it, and just our few minutes left, I'm going to throw you on the spot. The Appalachian Mountains, a lot of the sediments are very old. Cambrian rocks, Precambrian, half a billion to a billion years old. Mm-hmm. They were here, but the mountains may not have been. Am I getting that right?
That's right. If you look at the topography in the Piedmont today, mm-hmm. around Atlanta, Greenville, South Carolina, Columbia, South Carolina, that topography probably extended all the way over to where we are today. The other bits and pieces of evidence is pick up a map and look at where the headwaters are of the Hiwassee River, the Nolichucky, all these rivers that
they're
drain.
They're on the other side of the Smokies.
They drain into the Tennessee. They form
That's
the
right.
Tennessee.
That's right.
And they all have their headwaters on the other side of the mountain. So how did they get there? Why did they choose that route and not some other? This is one of the intriguing things that I am interested in thinking about.
Well, consider my mind blown. That is quite amazing, because again, we think of the Appalachians as just being these supremely old figures, and if it turns out that they aren't. Now, let me ask you this. How will you find out, or how will you and your colleagues find out? How can you test the theory that these are very young mountains? What would you be looking for?
Well, we're right now, I have a graduate student who's looking at sediments in the Gulf Coastal Plain, and we're going to look at the Atlantic Coastal Plain also and see where the minerals that are present, trace quantities in these sediments, were derived, and from uplifting Appalachians or some other place. We don't know those answers yet.
So you're going to go basically to the beach to look at sand that came originally from Tennessee and North Carolina and places that are nowhere near the ocean.
Yes. We've been in Mississippi very recently, as a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm. Well, what comes next for you? What other projects are you working on right now?
Well, the earthquakes project here is another one that's continuing.
Yeah. And Harry Moore, anything in your wheelhouse coming up?
Well, I'm actually working on four new books.
Wow, okay.
One on the like an update to the Gray Fossil Sign mm-hmm. book, an adventure fiction, and one about Ben Ballinger, a man who lived in a cave for 30 years up in Jefferson County. And then I've got a fourth book, more of a photo book. That's what I'm working on now.
How recently was Mr. Ballinger in that cave?
He passed away in August of 1969.
Okay.
So he lived there from 1939 to 1960.
Well, there you go. It's another example of geology and
man right
here. Yeah. Well, I'd like to thank our guests again, Bob Hatcher, distinguished scientist in geology and tectonics, professor at the University of Tennessee, past president of the Geological Society of America, and Harry Moore for years as a geologist with the Tennessee Department of Transportation, one of the discoverers and interpreters of the Gray Fossil Site. Thanks so much to the people who called in today with questions. Thanks again to our producer, Greg Hill, who also answered the phones. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth, and we'll see you again for Dialogue first Wednesday of the month. That'll be the first Wednesday in October, and I believe Chrissy Kuiper is going to be our host that month. In the meantime, you're listening to WUOT 91.9 FM in Knoxville, WUOT HD1 Knoxville, and WUOT.org, a service of the University of Tennessee since 1949.